Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're really in the know. You can find out about us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm George Scalise, a member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors and your moderator for tonight's program. And now, it's my pleasure to introduce today's special guest, Robert Reich, Chancellor's Professor at the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California in Berkeley, and the author of the book Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Professor Reich has served in three national administrations, most recently as Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton. Time magazine named him one of the 10 most effective cabinet secretaries of the last century. Now, that's quite an accolade. He has written 13 books, including his latest bestseller that I've just mentioned, Aftershock, and along with that, The Work of Nations, which has been translated into 22 languages. His syndicated columns, television appearances, and public radio commentaries reach millions of people each week. He is also the founding editor of the American Prospect magazine and chairman of the citizens group Common Clause. Please welcome Robert Reich.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, George, and it's a pleasure to see all of you tonight. I want to start out with a confession. If Mitt Romney becomes president, it's possible. If he becomes president, it is partly my responsibility. I will have, in a sense, made him president. Now, there is an irony here because I don't particularly want him to become president. In fact, I will do everything I can to prevent him, or for that matter, any Republican. Now, I don't want to make this a partisan evening, but I'm just giving you, this is all part of my confession. This is just a confession. But I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that Barack Obama is reelected. But let me get to the confession. Nonpartisan. The confession that I need to share with you, because it's been on my mind, especially after the Florida primary, is that I ran for governor of Massachusetts in 2002 in the Democratic primary. And there were six of us in that primary, and going into the last weeks, I was running neck and neck with the treasurer of Massachusetts for the number one slot. But I ran out of money. I mean, my election ran out of money. I just didn't have enough. And my campaign manager said, look, we can win this if you will put your home. You get a second mortgage on your home. And at that time, you know, we had expenses and my kids were still, in college or going to college. And I just said no. And my campaign manager said, then we're going to lose. And we lost. But if I had won the nomination and if I had been the Democratic nominee for governor of Massachusetts in 2002, I would have whipped Mitt Romney. And that would have ended his career and we would not have him anymore to worry about. And so it was all about my second mortgage. And I just... And I have that hanging around my neck, and I'm sorry, I had to get that off my neck and off my chest. Well, the economy looks like it's bouncing back a little bit. I'll get to that. President Obama, in the State of the Union, said very pointedly that the defining issue of the next nine, 10 months, this election year, is going to be whether the economy is working for all of us or whether it's working for just a few. The president made it very, very clear that one of the critical questions facing this country is fairness. Who is the economy for? And I agree with him But I want to go just slightly beyond what he said and suggest to you that the issue of fairness is not just a moral issue. It's not just an issue about whether we're all in the same boat together. And it is all of those things. But it also has to do with the success of the economy itself. As I said, the economy looks like it's doing a little bit better now. In fact, we know in the fourth quarter of 2011, we had an annualized growth of about 2.8%, which is very good. And it looks like the employment report coming up this Friday for January may be pretty good. In December, we had 200,000 net new jobs. Not bad. But this is still an extraordinarily painfully slow recovery. Most of the growth in the fourth quarter of 2011 had to do with inventory replacements, companies that got their inventory so low they just needed to replace their inventories. And some of that growth had to do with the fact that people had been holding on to their old cars so long they had to replace their old cars. Well, you can't have a vigorous recovery on the basis of replacements. It turns out that consumers whose spending is 70% of economic activity really have not spent all that much more. In fact, what we know is that in December they pulled back. It looked like at the beginning of Christmas season they were spending a little bit more, but then they actually retreated from the market. They started saving a little bit more of their incomes, presumably because the savings rate had got down so low they were scared. There is a fear factor that is still very much a part of this economy. I go out, spend time with people who are either trying to form unions or they're trying to mobilize to change politics a little bit, or they're trying to make sure that everybody gets what they are entitled to in terms of an earned income tax credit or whatever else. And what I hear over and over and over again, and some of the people in this room might be saying the same thing, is that the economy seems to be rigged in favor of a small number of people, but most of us are not getting by. Well, if you look at the data, what you see is something that is puzzling and also disturbing. In most economic recoveries, you get a fairly strong recovery, at least a recovery that is, in its strength, inversely related to how deep the hole is from which you want to emerge. The depths of the Great Depression of 1933, well, we had quite good growth in 1934. At even faster growth in 1935, ranging of 7%, 8%, 1936, we got up to 12 or 14% annualized growth. And if you stop to think about it, that's not surprising, because if you go into a deep hole, you've got a lot of underutilized capacity. You've got a lot of offices and factories that are not being utilized. You've also got a lot of people who are sitting around doing nothing. And so when the economy starts coming back, you need, if you are going to get back on the track you were on originally before you fell into the hole, you need to have a lot of growth. And you get that growth usually because you've got all of that underutilized capacity. Well, we fell into a very deep hole in 2008. We fell into the deepest hole we've fallen into since the Great Depression, not as deep as the Great Depression, but it was a very, very deep hole nonetheless. And when we see growth in the range of 2%, that's not nearly good enough. Even when we see employment in the range of 200,000 a month, that's not going to get us back. If we have 200,000 a month, it's going to take us to the year 2019 or 2020 before we get back to 5% unemployment. We're not doing nearly well enough. And given that consumers are so scared and consumer spending is still in the doldrums, how do we ever get enough demand in the system to justify more hiring at good wages? You see, it's circular. Consumers are workers, workers are consumers. And if people don't have jobs and their wages are going nowhere, and the bottom 90%, their wages are still trending downward, then they don't have the wherewithal to turn around and buy. And if they can't buy, then they're not going to be jobs. This is not rocket science. Now, we've had a big debate in this country over the last couple of years about how large the stimulus should be. Now the debate is about how large the stimulus should have been. And predictably, you've got certain people on one side saying, well, the stimulus didn't work, just did not work. You've got other people on the other side, of which I am one, saying the stimulus was not big enough. In fact, Larry Summers, who was the president's chief economist, apparently he wrote a memo in late 2008 that was just leaked. I don't know why somebody would just leak a memo. From late 2008, who could be interested in a memo like that, except if you're sort of an insider's insider insider? But I was interested because, for one thing, he remembered, or at least in the memo, it stated that I had recommended, and I was one of the Obama advisors at that time, I had recommended that the size of the stimulus package be $1.2 trillion. Now, that was more than twice as large as the stimulus turned out to be. I thought that was the approximate right size because given how much the economy had lost, how deep the hole was, it seemed to me that you needed that degree of stimulus to just get us back. Consumers and businesses were going to be pulling back. They would not nearly respond to the shortfall. Government has got to be the spender of last resort. Yes, that's Keynesianism. I'm proud to be a Keynesian. Because Keynesianism is correct. You see, you've got a lot of supply-side people that said all you have to do is reduce taxes. And you reduce taxes on corporations and they will hire. Well, they're not going to hire. I mean, corporations are sitting on over $1 trillion of cash right now. If they needed cash, they have the cash. They're buying their own stock back. They don't know what to do with the cash. They're not hiring because there are not enough customers for them. And there are not enough customers because consumers are still scared and they don't have the cash. This is not Keynesianism. This is common sense. But there's something else and something deeper and something more troubling to all of this that is not being talked about nearly enough. The president mentioned it in his State of the Union, but he mentioned it in the context of fairness. But it is a bigger issue. And let me explain it to you. Because with widening inequality, when more and more and more of the income and the wealth of the country go to the top 1%, or to the top 0.1%, the vast middle class no longer has the purchasing power to keep the economy going. Now, again, this is just common sense. The 2 years over the past 100 years that were the peak record years, the peak years in terms of how much and how large a share and percentage of the total national income went to the top 1%. Those peak years of inequality were 1928 and 2007. Now, what do we know about 1928 and 2007. I mean, these are not just random years. Something happened the year after 1928 and 2007. You see, if consumers don't have enough purchasing power, what do? They go deeper and deeper into debt. And eventually that debt bubble bursts. And then after it bursts, there is not only a possibility of a financial calamity, but beyond the financial calamity, consumers don't have enough money to keep the economy going. aside from a replacement economy. And what Franklin D. Roosevelt understood is that you had to restructure the economy in some profound ways. Not only a WPA and a CCC to get a lot of people who are unemployed employed, but you also had to provide the rights and the union rights for people to organize and require that employers bargain in good faith. You had to provide Social Security. You had to provide unemployment insurance. You had to provide a 40-hour work week with time and a half for overtime. All of these things that we now take for granted were innovations, and they restructured the economy to widen the circle of prosperity so that when the economy expanded, more and more people had a share of that expansion, and they could use the money they had to turn around and buy things. And when they bought things, that created more jobs. It was a virtuous cycle instead of a vicious cycle. Again, this is not too hard to understand. But this time around, we haven't done it. We did do enough to stop a run on the banks. We did avoid a financial calamity, but we did not address the inequality that was removing the capacity of the vast middle class to be the drivers of the economy. The people at the top can't be the drivers of the economy. Why? Because the richer you are, and this is not an attack on the rich, I'm not a class warrior, I'm a class worrier. The difference is the richer you are, the more likely it is you're going to save more of your income than spend it. And that's, in ordinary times, that's good. You want people to save income, that's fine. But when you're worried about the economy having enough oomph to get out of a recession, when you're worried about an economy actually having enough power behind it to create jobs, if so much of the income and wealth are going to the top and they're saving it, and their savings naturally are going around the world wherever they can get the best return, you're not having and creating enough demand in your economy to keep that economy going. And you're toying with huge speculative booms and debt bubbles that burst. And if you don't restructure the economy for greater equality, not equality, I'm not saying you have to have total equality. I'm just simply saying just something that is more normal. Now, in the 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s, for example, the top 1% took home about between 9 and 10% of total income. But by the time we got to 2007, the top 1% was taking home 23.5% of total income. And ironically, paradoxically, perhaps not coincidentally, back in 1928, what percentage of total income was the top 1% taking home? 23.5%. You see, we have sort of almost a built-in trigger. When you hit something in the order of 23.5%, your debt bubble balloons and busts, and then you've got a major problem that can last years, years. And that's what I fear. We will get the unemployment report for January on Friday. It may say something like 180,000, 200,000, 220,000 jobs, not nearly enough. Most economists now are looking at the rest of this year and saying, oh, we expect around 2% growth. Not nearly enough. We're not going to be able to get out of the vicious cycle we are in unless we have policies that restructure the economy as dramatically to widen the circle of prosperity as we had in the 1930s. But no politician is going near that. Now, the president's proposals are steps in the right direction. He's talking about creating incentives for companies to create more manufacturing jobs in America. That's good. He's talking about having a kind of Buffett tax, a minimum tax, top marginal tax of 30% on incomes over $1 million, that's a step in the right direction, I assume. He's talking about investing in education and infrastructure. Well, that's very important. Well, we also have a huge budget deficit in the out years. We've got to do something about that. I would say, and I will only say it among friends, and I hope you don't repeat this because if it gets out that I said this, it's going to be, I'm just hell to pay. But it seems to me that, you know, given that the top marginal rate in the 1950s under Dwight Eisenhower, whom nobody would accuse and did accuse of being a socialist, Dwight Eisenhower was a Republican. He had been a former general. I remember him on television. We had a little tiny television, a little television that was this big. It was we had one of the first televisions in our neighborhood, and we'd sit there. My father and I would sit there watching Dwight Eisenhower. It was very boring. I don't know how many of you probably don't remember listening or watching Dwight Eisenhower. He was the most boring speaker we have ever had as president. But under Dwight Eisenhower, who nobody accused of being a socialist, the top marginal rate on what would be the equivalent today of millionaires was 91%. Now, even if you take away all deductions and all tax credits, the effective rate in those days was still between 52 and 60%. I mean, we're not talking about nearly that. The Buffett rule, which has as much chance of being enacted this year as I do of growing. That Buffett rule sets a minimum of 30%. And again, that's considered radical. Well, let me just assure you, it's not radical. I would urge that we work for a high marginal income tax on incomes over $1 million, including a capital gains tax that is the same as the income tax, so there's no gaming the system, and that it be substantial. Maybe it be the average of the high marginal tax and capital gains tax from 1946 to 1981, which was very high, relative speaking. And the economy did not do badly in those years. In fact, average growth per year in that 30-year period was higher than the average growth has been over the last 30 years. This is going to be an interesting year in terms of coming up to one of the most important elections we have had. That is said all the time, one of the most important elections. But what disturbs me and worries me, quite honestly, is that we will not be debating proposals that are large enough to do very much about the underlying issue that the president himself has raised. Indeed, the issue is, and the defining issue, is how we get an economy that is working for all of us and not just a very few. His proposals are steps in the right direction, but they are too modest for us to really get there. My hope is that he gets enough of a mandate on Election Day to give him the courage, but also to give all of us who feel this way the courage to mobilize and organize and change the economy so it is genuinely working for all of us. Nothing good happens in Washington, no matter how good the people are there. Nothing good happens in Washington unless good people outside Washington are mobilized and organized and energized to make it happen in Washington. In the election of 1936, Franklin D. Roosevelt, running for re-election, was accosted by a woman who said to him, "Mr. President, if I vote for you, if you're re-elected, you've got to do this and this and this and this." And he stopped her. He said, "Ma'am, I'd like to do all those things. But in order to do them, you must make me." Now, what did he mean by that? He meant that a democracy only functions for the people and not for the moneyed interests, only functions for the people when the people rise and are heard. If the people just think politics is about electing somebody and then go home and forget it, we're going to be back to where we were before. we're not going to see the changes we need. Thanks very much.
Okay,
so now your questions.
Okay, thank you, Professor Reich. And now it is time for the questions, and I've got a pile of them here. And I've tried to begin by sorting them into some kind of related points of interest. But this first one, I think, stands by itself. How do you rate President Obama's performance thus far in a scale of 1 to 10?
I only give letter grades. You know, this term at Berkeley, I actually have 780 students. And they are fabulous. Fabulous, fabulous students. I would give him a anywhere between an A minus and a B plus. I think he has been up. I think that he has faced the most intransigent, disciplined, unified, negative Republican Party I have ever seen in my lifetime. And it's amazing that he got as much done as he did. He also was up against the worst economy in my lifetime. And he's done reasonably well. Now, again, I didn't give him an A, and I would never give him an A plus, because I was disappointed that he did not more forcefully stand up to the Republicans, and I think that he could have negotiated much more. He could have been tougher with them. But that's just my view.
Okay. As a former labor secretary, how do you see the attacks on labor unions at the state level?
The attack on, if you're talking about the attack on public employees,
right,
going on in Wisconsin and in fact going on in many states, but centered, the epicenter is Wisconsin and Ohio, and to some extent Indiana. Indiana is going beyond. It's seeking to become a so-called right-to-work state. I think the attack on public employees is misguided for the following reason. If you control for education, actually, look apples to apples. Public employees with the same educational background as private sector employees, the pay is just about the same. If you look at benefits, public employees are doing a little bit better than private sector employees on the benefit side in terms of their educational level. But to me, that just means that we've allowed a major erosion of private sector benefits for employees. And I don't think the way to correct that is to go downward. I think the way to correct that is to equalize upward. I do think public employees, I would say with regard to teachers, for example, I don't know. I mean, yes, I think teachers ought to agree to more pay for performance, and I think we ought to demand from teachers that when they're in the classrooms, they actually teach and that we get results. But let me tell you something. My sister is a public school teacher. I am a product of the public schools. Many people here are in the product of the public schools. For years, this country had a free ride off the fact that there were not many alternative career openings for talented professional women other than going to school and teaching. And that was fine. We got a great free ride out of it. But if we want to attract high-quality, talented people into our classrooms, whether they are men or women, we got to pay for them.
I think this is a bit related to that question, and whether the statistic is correct, I don't know. 78% of college grads since 2008 are in non-career positions. Supposedly, they'll lose 20% of their total lifetime earning capacity. How do we reclaim this talent and accelerate them to catch up?
Well, if we're talking about non-career positions, I think what you're referring to is the fact that career ladders are disappearing. In most professions, They're just blurred, or they're gone. My students ask me, well, what am I supposed to do? How can I plan my life? And I tell them that because I look at labor markets very carefully and I look at what companies are doing, there is no career path any longer. You've got to continuously learn on the job. You've got to make as many connections as you possibly can. You've got to understand, sadly, that your employer, chances are, particularly if you're working for a sizable firm, has as much loyalty to you as the employer has to a supplier, the country, which is no loyalty at all. I mean, if the employer is there to make profits. And that, unfortunately, as George, you and I were talking about before, George and I had a conversation about this. You know, before the 1980s, the typical company in the United States, even a big company, felt that it had a mutual obligation to its employers, and the employees had an obligation to the employer. That is, it was bound together by a sense that everybody was working together and in the same boat. And that's why people stayed with a company for 20 or 30 or 40 years. But now there is no loyalty left. And many people in this particular Great Recession, and we are still in the Great Recession from the standpoint of jobs, people have had a firsthand experience and glimpse of the fact that there is no loyalty left at all. And so there are no career paths. And aside from continuously learning, sharpening your skills, making connections, and anticipating that you are likely to be sacrificed if you're not keeping up to high value for your entire career, I can't advise anybody any longer.
That is going to be a challenge. This is a question, or there's a number of questions here with regard to the Occupy movement. So I'm just going to try and summarize with, do you see the Occupy movement as growing or failing? And what two or three specific issues should they be dealing with?
Well, I don't know exactly what the Occupy movement is because it's different things in different places. I've been asked to go around the country and speak in various locations that had been occupier locations, and I found very different groups culturally, demographically. Some were middle class, some were poor, some were old, some were white, some were mixed, some were Hispanic. And they all had slightly different issues, but what united all of them was a sense of outrage about just exactly what I've been talking about, widening inequality, the fact that the game seems rigged, that their children are unlikely to get ahead, or that they've been working and playing by the rules, and they are now in trouble. Mortgages, or whatever else the issue is. Now, people ask me, has the movement been successful so far? And I have to say yes, in the sense that I can't believe that the President of the United States would premise his State of the Union address on these same issues, had the issues not been on the front pages of the nation's newspapers and websites and television programs for the last 4 months. In other words, the Occupier movement has facilitated a major national discussion about something that was under the surface, that a lot of people were too intimidated to talk about if they were in public life because they were going to be called and accused of being a class warrior. But on the other hand, where does the Occupier movement go from here? I don't know. I condemn violence. I think it is absolutely reprehensible. And it is not the way to change anybody's mind. On the other hand, there has to be a way for good people, people who care about this country, to come together and not be maced and tear-gassed and told that the First Amendment does not protect them, when in fact they're told at the same time that the First Amendment treats money as speech and corporations as people. Something wrong with that picture.
Let's go back to the administration and Congress. And I guess the question here is Simpson-Bowles, a bipartisan effort seem to have come together with a set of initiatives that probably no one would like all of, but everyone would like some of. Why haven't we adopted that? Why haven't we used that as the foundation to deal with the deficit reduction issue?
Well, for one thing, Alan Simpson is way too tall. You see, you know, he's a good friend of mine, even though he is a conservative Republican, but we can't even get in the same photograph. But there are other reasons as well. I think that Simpson Bowles made a lot of sense, but there are two big problems. And I think that both the Republicans and the Democrats sniffed out the problems in their own different ways. One problem with Simpson Bowles is that it does not take account of the sequencing issue that has got to lie behind any attempt to deal with the budget deficit. And when I say sequencing issue, I simply mean this. It makes no sense at all to try to cut the budget deficit and to cut spending when you have so much unemployment. What you ought to do is have a trigger built in so that you don't actually cut until unemployment gets down to something like 5%, something like what it was before the Great Recession. And once it hits that point, then you can unleash the deficit cutters. That would be fine. That would be appropriate. But unless you have that trigger, unless you understand that sequence, that before you hit that trigger, you actually need to spend more in order to stimulate the economy. And after you hit the trigger, then you can actually reduce the deficit. Unless you understand that, you get caught in the austerity trap, which Europeans are now caught in. Because remember, the fundamental issue is not the debt per se. It's the ratio of the debt to the GDP, to the national economy. We were talking about Franklin D. Roosevelt in World War II. Well, when I was a little boy in the 50s, my father said to me, "You, Bobby, you and your children and your children's children will be paying down the debt that Franklin D. Roosevelt created." And I had no idea. I was 4 years old. I didn't know what a debt was. I had a hard time sleeping, I remember, because I had this issue, this vision of a debt that would keep me up. And my children would be paying, and my grandchildren. But the reality is that by the late 50s, nobody was talking about the debt that Franklin D. Roosevelt created, even though we kept on spending. We had a Korean War. We had a Cold War. We rebuilt Europe. We rebuilt Japan. We had an interstate highway system. We didn't stop spending. No, the big difference was that the denominator of the equation, the GDP, grew rapidly. That's what you have to focus on, growth. In Europe right now, they're cutting their deficits before they're growing. And what does that mean? It means that their growth has stopped. In fact, they're in deeper recessions. They're contracting their economies, which makes the debt-GDP ratio even worse than it was before. You see the trap. Let's not fall for that trap. The other problem with Simpson Bowles, I'll tell you, is that it didn't acknowledge what everybody should know, and that is that there are two big drivers to the deficit in the out years. One is health care costs. Particularly when you think of all those 77 million baby boomers whose bodies are all going to corrode together, and you have healthcare costs going like this, and baby boomers are all going to need healthcare. Well, there's no way we as a nation, whether we're talking about Medicare or Medicaid or even private medical insurance, can possibly deal with that. And then the second big driver is the military and defense costs. And although there are cuts scheduled, they are not nearly as large as would be appropriate given the fact that our defense budget is already, we're spending more on defense than we've ever spent, and we're spending we're spending more than the next five nations, including China, put together spend on defense. I mean, our base budget, we don't have time to get into all of this, but let me just explain to you. There's really two military budgets. There is the basic budget that's not about fighting wars. That's the cost of simply sustaining military and adding weapons systems without the cost of adding a war. It's like the cost of having a car without the cost of driving it. And that basic military budget is scheduled to keep on growing. What we're cutting in future years, according to at least the proposals that Leon Panetta and the president are proposing, That cut has to do with fighting wars, because the assumption is we're going to be pulling out, and we've already started pulling out of Iraq and hopefully Afghanistan. But you see, it's the base budget that keeps growing, and that does not make any sense. You get control over military spending and control over health care, rising health care costs, and you've conquered the budget problem over the long term.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is Robert Reich, professor at UC Berkeley and former U.S. Secretary of Labor, who is discussing the outlook for America in 2012. The next question is kind of a related one to some of the things you were just alluding to there, talking about. What do you see as a likely outcome of the Eurozone financial crisis, and how will it affect the U.S. economy over the next decade?
Well, the Eurozone financial crisis, just embarking from where I ended, if they are going to continue with this insane austerity economics, that crisis is going to just get worse and worse. Greece is in a worse position today than it was in 3 months ago. And on top of that, you're having more and more civil unrest because people are seeing they're losing their jobs, they're losing their wages, and they're losing public services at the same time. So this is not sustainable. Now, the big problem for us is twofold. Number one, our exports to Europe are going to be declining, and they are declining because Europeans can't afford to buy. That's not a dramatic problem for us, but it does cut down on demand, and we already have a demand-side problem. The second problem is the exposure of Wall Street banks to the possible failure of some big European banks. And Wall Street banks are very busy reassuring everybody, don't worry, because we have it all under control. We have credit default swaps. We've insured ourselves. No, really, I'm not kidding. It's as if nobody remembers AIG. It's as if we sort of blotted all of that out of our memories. But I am concerned about the potential exposure, and we don't have enough transparency still in Wall Street financial markets to know how much exposure is really there. So I think that's room for concern. Now, there are two big advantages. I don't expect politicians or anybody else publicly to talk much about this in the United States, but there are two big American advantages to what's happening in Europe. Number one, the cost of a lot of commodities worldwide is going down, like oil, because the demand worldwide is going down because Europe is in such bad shape. And that means a lot of the expenditures, supplies that we need, are not costing nearly as much. Food and energy, the primary examples. And number two, everybody is so scared about what's happening in Europe that they're putting all of their money into the United States, into T-bills. And that means, the yield on a 10-year treasury is hovering around 2%. Well, that's great for us. In fact, if we were being sensible, given that given the fact we have huge unemployment, and at the same time we've got deferred maintenance on our roads and bridges and pipes and all kinds of infrastructure, and the cost of borrowing, that 10-year treasury yield at 2%, the cost of borrowing is historically extremely low. If we were smart, we would embark upon a major infrastructure program right now.
So related to that, what do you think the newly announced housing program will do to help homeowners that are now underwater? And perhaps related to that, the rescinding of Glass-Steagall, did it help, did it hurt, should it be reinstated?
Well, let me deal with both of those. There is a relationship between both of those questions. First of all, nothing seems to work very well with regard to the continuing drop, the continuing drop in housing prices. We've got a lot of people. The estimates are anywhere between 1 in 4 and 1 in 5 people with a mortgage is underwater, owing more on their homes than the homes are worth, and that's driving down prices all over the place. Certainly defaults and forfeitures Now, what do you do with that? Well, the government programs, I think that the government program that was announced, the proposed program, makes a lot of sense to me. But there's another thing that we could do. In fact, there are two things we could do. One would be for us to amend, for government to amend the bankruptcy laws so that you could declare bankruptcy on your primary residence. The big advantage of doing that, you can't do that right now, but the big advantage of doing that is that it would give homeowners more leverage with their lenders in terms of reorganizing that home loan. The second thing we could do is have the FHA turn a loan into equity. That is, we do this all the time. We have debt equity swaps in all kinds of areas of our life, financial life. Well, why not have the FHA, or it could be another branch of another part of a HUD? All you do is you say to a homeowner, look, we will take off your shoulders a certain percentage of your mortgage debt, in return for which we want an equity stake in your home, so that when the home improves in value, and someday when you sell, if you ever sell, you will eventually, or you'll die, something's going to happen. When that happens, we get the equity advantage. We get the gain on a pro rata basis. Now, the connection here to the second part of your question, George, has to do with, you just asked about Glass-Steagall. Well, Glass-Steagall, the one thing that I'm least proud of that happened during the Clinton administration, now I was no longer there, the Clinton administration joined with Wall Street and congressional Republicans in repealing the Glass-Steagall Act in 1999. And Glass-Steagall is the act that separated investment banking from commercial banking. That was a Depression-era bill and act. It was very important to not only safeguard commercial depositors, but also to reduce the possibility of another blow-up like we had in 1929. Well, we got rid of that, and that made, and by getting rid of it, we enabled banks to become kind of supermarkets, and they could, in effect, utilize commercial deposits, insured deposits, and utilize them directly and indirectly to gamble with. And when it came time for the Dodd-Frank bill, the bank said, no, don't you dare resurrect Glass-Steagall. We'll go along at most with something called the Volcker Rule, which was kind of a watered-down, more complicated version of Glass-Steagall. Well, it turns out they went along with that. I hate to say it because I don't want to sound cynical. But it turns out that my cynicism was justified because they went along with that Volcker Rule because they knew they could water it down even further in the agencies and in the regulatory process, and now we have a 300-page Volcker Rule that nobody can understand and that has loopholes large enough for Wall Street bankers to drive their Ferraris through. And the fact of the matter is, we should have, and we do need to resurrect Glass-Steagall. That is the only protection we really have in terms of making sure that the casino side is controlled. Now, the reason it's related to the housing question is because TARP, you remember TARP? I mean, never was there an acronym that so appropriately, you use a TARP to cover things up, right? Well, the Troubled Assets Relief Program was supposed to and was intended to deal not only with the problems of the banks and also ensure their liquidity and make sure there wasn't a run on the banks, but it was also intended to help homeowners. And what I don't know why the Obama administration did not do this. I understand why the George W. Bush administration didn't. But why the Obama administration did not require the banks as a condition of getting TARP money to renegotiate directly or indirectly the principles of all of those mortgages that were out there, I don't know. They should have done that. And now that there is another opportunity. Now there's another opportunity. There's another opportunity because that big system-wide, this big system-wide settlement of all of the liability, all of the cases, the civil cases that are have been running around against the banks, that big system-wide settlement is, I think, And remember, the money that would come in from that settlement, some of it was going to be used to help these homeowners. Well, the president has announced, I think appropriately, that settlement is not good enough. And that's going to be renegotiated, I believe. And maybe that's another way to get some relief to homeowners. But one final point. You've got to understand that for most Americans, their homes are their major assets. They have little or nothing on Wall Street. For most Americans, their homes are their assets. And home values have dropped 30 to 33% since 2006. And that means most people not only are worried about their jobs and their incomes, but they're also very much worried about not having savings. Now, what they should do and what you should do and what everybody should do is look at my financial strategy. My financial strategy has always been, and it always works, buy high and sell low. I bought my house in Berkeley in 2006. Not only was it at the apex of the housing market, but I bought my house in Berkeley the very month that was the apex of the housing market. In fact, I think, although I haven't been able to get quite enough data, I think the moment I bought my house in Berkeley, my house was worth less, and it's still worth less. So that's another way for kind of an inside tip that I'm giving all of you free of charge.
Well, given that tip and some of the thoughts you have with regard to how we're going to come out of this downturn that we've been struggling with, are you concerned that the rapid growth of the U.S. money supply could lead to much higher inflation in the years ahead?
No. No, I mean, inflation is the last thing we need. When you have all of this underutilized capacity, when you have so many people unemployed, when you have so many factories and offices that are empty, how can you worry about inflation? Inflation is not going to happen. Inflation happens when you have a constraint on your capacity, when you have at or near full employment, when everything is actually running full speed, and the only thing you can do is bid up prices. It's lunacy to worry about inflation.
I think that answers that
question. Did I make myself clear?
Yeah. Let's turn to China for just a minute. They certainly have emerged as a major player in the economy. They are becoming the manufacturing center of the world. What do you see in the future, the impact that China will have on the U.S. economy?
I don't view China and the United States locked into a zero-sum game in which either they gain or we lose or we gain and they lose. I think it can be and should be a positive-sum game. China is not our enemy. Just before this program, George and I were talking about work that both of us did in the 1980s, where our nemesis in those days was Japan. And not China. Some of you remember, we thought Japan was eating our lunch, and there were all sorts of moves to take retaliatory action against Japan, and we were worried about trade with Japan. Well, it's the same thing now. We're making China into the fall guy. Some people, in fact, many, many people, politicians in Washington on both sides of the aisle, are moving to push or trying to force China to raise its currency on the theory that the China currency is being manipulated and is too low, which are hurting our exports and giving them an artificial boost to their exports. Well, there's some truth to that, but let me tell you something. That's not the heart of the problem we are facing. And anybody who thinks that Chinese currency manipulation or having them revalue the yuan is actually going to make much of a difference to the United States economy has got to be living on another planet. I mean, first of all, a lot of companies that are over there making stuff for export to the United States, if the yuan is revalued upward, they're just going to go to Vietnam or Indonesia or Thailand. I mean, they're going to still do it in Asia. Secondly, much of what we are getting from China is assembled in China. The actual stuff is coming from the supplies. The components are coming from all over Asia, and some of them are coming from the United States and going to China for assembly and coming back. But they are treated for the purposes of international accounting as if they are exports from China. So the actual export problem from China is much smaller. And third, China is actually revaluing the yuan. It is rising, and Chinese wages are rising. So it's, you know, yes, that's it's nice, it's a good thing to keep some pressure on them to go in that direction, but it's not going to solve any problem here in the United States.
What are your thoughts with regard to the repatriation of overseas earnings at a lower interest rate or a lower tax rate or perhaps no tax? How do you see it?
Well, I am all in favor of repatriating earnings, but I don't like the idea of an amnesty because I worry. We've given amnesties before, and the problem with amnesties is that it's the old problem of moral hazard. Now, interestingly, conservatives are very quick on the moral hazard button when it comes to individuals. But when it comes to companies, they're all in favor of amnesties. Well, I'm a little bit opposite. It seems to me that companies are much more rational in the very limited sense of rationality in terms of looking at their bottom lines than individuals are. A lot of individuals are not all that quote-unquote rational. And companies treated to an amnesty are going to wait for the next amnesty, or they're just not going to play the game fairly. I think we need a tax system on international transactions, on corporate earnings, that makes some rational sense. We don't want companies to transfer their savings or their earnings or in the United States or wherever they're earned to jurisdictions that are the lowest tax jurisdictions for simply the purpose of avoiding paying taxes. And there ought to be international treaties to that extent. And anybody who is complaining, in fact, I hear every day, I go on these shows, these talk shows, where somebody yells at me, and I try not to yell back, but I occasionally yell back. And I don't know how anybody hears anything. But I was on one this afternoon. I don't know how many of you listen to Larry Kudlow's show. Do you ever see it? You don't watch it. You don't know it. You've never heard of it. Well, anyway, so much for my efforts. But I went on there, I think it was today. I go in there a couple times a week, and I argue. Recently, either today or yesterday, we talked about international taxes, and the point was made. No, it was today. And Senator Hutchinson from Texas said corporations are taxed too high. We need to reduce taxation, and she was very favorably disposed to a tax amnesty and all of that stuff. The fact of the matter is, as I suggested before, corporations are not overtaxed. And the big global corporations are avoiding taxes altogether. GE paid no taxes last year at all, as far as I remember. Corporations should pay their fair share. Especially if they want to be considered people under the First Amendment. You know, I will believe corporations are people under the First Amendment when Texas and Alabama begin executing them.
On a more serious note, what do you really think young people can do today to affect change that is going to improve their opportunity in the years ahead?
The question is, what can young people do to affect change in ways that are going to improve their opportunities in the years ahead? Well, there are many ways that young people can affect change. I've never actually been asked the question of how they can affect change and improve their opportunities. Well, let me understand that question the following way. How can young people actually have a positive impact on our society and also at the same time do reasonably well? Not necessarily make a fortune, but have enough to live on. And there are a lot of things they can do. And I tell young people all the time, they can either directly get involved in politics, or they can indirectly get involved in politics through their communities. Young people are incredibly interested and engaged in public service, more now than I think I've seen at any time over the last 30 years I've been teaching. But they often don't define public service as politics or elections. They actually hold their nose when they think about politics. They define public service and service as service to their community, as getting involved in a lot of quite important social services. But I would say do both. Can you make a living? Well, you can make a living. You're not going to make a fortune. What about the not-for-profit sector? Yes, there are many, many opportunities. We have a vibrant NGOs, vibrant not-for-profits. In fact, the Bay Area is one of the most intensive areas in terms of per capita not-for-profit activity, and not-for-profits are doing wonderful things in the Bay Area and for the world from the Bay Area. And I urge a lot of my students don't go into not-for-profits. What about the private sector? Well, there are many opportunities in the private sector to do good and do well at the same time. And I don't think it is fair or appropriate to simply assume that the private sector is just about making money and not also about improving people's lives. But it is very important, I tell young people, that when you're going into the private sector, you keep a very, very clear idea. And this is important even going into the public sector, and even the not-for-profit. But whether you're going into the, if you're going directly into the public sector, into Washington or in politics, or going into the private sector, be aware and keep an eye on your own integrity. Because sometimes you can be sucked into situations where means and ends get confused. And that is what having an ethical compass is all about. Keeping an eye on your own integrity.
Now, your audience may not have seen the Kledlow Report, but they do read what you write in the Chronicle. And the question is, what response have you had from your Chronicle article where you suggested that Hillary become the vice presidential running mate and Joe Biden become the Secretary of State?
Joe wasn't happy. No, I didn't hear anything from him, and I haven't heard anything from Hillary Clinton. You know, I dated her once, before she was married. I did, when she was in college. That's another confession. There are two confessions in one evening. But I do think that it would be a wise move, as I said in that article. I think that what Barack Obama, President Obama, is going to have to do is to get his base stirred up, the Democratic base, excited again. I think that some people are excited and will be excited merely because of re-election, and some will be angry and excited because Romney or but you, there still needs to be some, you know, some, it still would be useful to, and she's just extraordinarily intelligent, as many of you know, and also a terrific campaigner. Joe Biden has wanted to be Secretary of State in the past. He's very interested in foreign affairs. That switch seems to me to make a lot of sense. Now, people say back to me, not directly from, I haven't heard anything directly from the administration or from Hillary Clinton, but people say back to me, but no, she doesn't want to do it. She said again and again she doesn't want it. And I say back, so what? I mean, if the president asks you, and if you can help a president and help the country, then you're going to do it. And I think she would do it. So I'm still of the mind that that is likely to happen. And I think that I've also said that if Mitt Romney is going to be the Republican nominee, I predict that he is going to select Marco Rubio as his running mate. You heard it here.
Well, we're at that point where we have the last question. We've run out of time. And I'm going to take you all the way back to your opening comment. With a turnout like this, you should be running for something. What are you going to run for?
You know, I learned something when I ran for governor of Massachusetts. I learned that I, and many of you, are just like me. You may not know it. I didn't know it until I tried. I'm not really suited to doing the job of campaigning. You've got to raise a lot of money, sadly. And raising a lot of money means that you've got to sit behind a telephone. Now, I can deal with humiliation. I've dealt with humiliation. But I want you to really get this picture in your head, okay? For 9 months, 5 hours a day, 6 days a week, I was at a telephone calling people, asking them for money to support my campaign. Some of them hung up. A number of them called me names. Some old friends said things like, "Are you shitting me?" Now, most of you could do that for a month, or maybe a week. But for 9 months, no. Our campaign finance system is awful. And this is really a good point to end on, because I agreed to become chairman of an organization called Common Cause, because founded by John Gardner, a Republican, member of the cabinet, 40 years ago, and it was founded on the principle that we've got to get big money out of politics if we're going to get our democracy back. And its principle and its goals are never as relevant as they are today. The Supreme Court, by deciding that money is speech and corporations are people, finally, most recently with that Citizens United case, has opened the floodgates. And right now it is possible for any individual in this country who has the money to write out a check for any amount of money, or any corporation and executives to write out a check for any amount of money, and basically, because campaigns are so dependent on money and television advertising and advertising in general, basically steer the public in the direction of one person or another. This is not the way a democracy is supposed to run. And if you combine that with what I started saying initially, that is, you've got now an almost unprecedented amount of money and wealth at the very top of society. Combine that fact with the fact that any amount of money can now find its way into any political campaign. You've got a fundamental challenge to our idea of a democracy, and we cannot allow that to continue. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Robert Reich, professor at the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of the book, Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. We also thank our audiences here on television, radio, and the Internet. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you know, is now adjourned. Thank you.